How the Iraqi See Their Future by Ian Fisher. Adad, Iraq. Here are two brief glimpses into the divided Iraqi mind at a moment when Iraqis, no less than Americans, are being forced into ever worse choices. Ghazi Mukhlif Hamdan, a 31-year-old man, without a job, was waiting for hours in front of the trash-strewn entrance to Abu Ghraib prison. He was there to make an appointment to see an uncle inside. The talk on the line was of the abuses at the hands of American guards and a loss of trust so great that even civil war seemed preferable to occupation. "Let them leave," Mr. Hamdan said. "Let hell come after that." Inside a tasteful room in the Karada neighborhood of Baghdad sat Adil Abdul Mehdi, a chubby, gray-haired, intelligent man, whose name circulates here as a possible Iraqi prime minister. He recounted how, a year ago, he was handcuffed during a raid at his political party's headquarters as American soldiers in a very brutal way, he bristled, debated whether to kill him. "Should I shoot him, sir?" Mr. Mehdi said, one soldier asked his superior. "Should I blast his head?" a reporter asked Mr. Mehdi, a Shiite Muslim politician who has since remained largely cooperative with the Americans, if he had been able to forgive the soldiers. He suggested that forgiveness was really beside the point. "We are very patient," he said. Mr. Hamdan and Mr. Mehdi stand for pretty much the only two choices left to Iraqis: resistance against the Americans even in the knowledge that it could lead to chaos, or bare tolerance of the occupation as the only way of avoiding, or even just postponing, that chaos. For people like Mr. Hamdan, and the numbers of those who share his opinion seem to be growing, pride and dignity trump any fears for the future. For people like Mr. Mehdi, resistance is a luxury that Iraq cannot afford. Iraqis must patiently stomach the Americans, for all their faults, and extract promises of money and support for long-term stability. For all the explosions and assassinations now, the fear is that the violence could lead to something far worse, a future that cleaves the nation along ethnic and religious lines, in which neighbor could rise up to slaughter neighbor. Bosnia was bad enough, but it is likely that the killing here would be intensified by a prize absent there, one of the world's largest oil supplies. For Americans grasping for a reason to stay optimistic about their experiment in Iraq, it may be this: there are still far more people in Mr. Mehdi's camp, people who are skeptical of, and maybe even hate, the Americans, but see them as the only way to save themselves. Sadim Samir, 23, a political science student at the University of Baghdad, found that out in research he did for a recent class paper in which he canvassed five neighborhoods, mostly in the poorer area of the capital's southern section. The answer that everyone gave was, "It's been a year, and they have done nothing for us," he said. "But after that I asked, 'Do you want them to leave?' And they all said, 'No, it's going to be more chaotic.' I don't know if that is a contradiction as much as what I might call a weakness. It's weakness and fear." But his research also uncovered limits to the hope that Iraqis will make, in the end, a rational and self-protective choice about their future. The recent surge in violence is beginning to make people feel that the Americans are no longer in control, that they have broken faith with Iraqis, that the mere fact of an American occupation in Iraq is what is driving the violence. No one has to look far for evidence: the abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, the suicide bombing last week that killed Azadine Salim, president of the Iraqi Governing Council, literally at the gates of the American headquarters here, continued fighting in the Shiite holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. And even American officials here say they believe that the violence will get worse with the approach of June 30th, the day when Iraqis are supposed to gain some measure of sovereignty. One of Mr. Samir's fellow students, Nuralan, 18, a modern young woman who does not cover her head like her more religiously observant friends, said she has noticed a shift in her own family's attitude about the Americans' loss of control. "I used to say to my family that it's okay for the Americans to stay because they will bring prosperity," she said. "Then the other day, I started to say it when I saw on TV the pictures from Abu Ghraib. I couldn't finish my sentence. My family said, 'What are you talking about? It's getting worse.' In short, many Iraqis have less reason to leave the category that American officials often call defense sitters, people who do not resist but are unwilling to commit to the American project for fear that it will not work. Added to that is the reality that the insurgents have methodically made targets of Iraqis, like policemen and politicians, who work for new government institutions. And fence-sitting is seeming like a more reasonable option these days. Who really knows where the American soldiers will be in, say, a year from now? Their withdrawal does not seem impossible, given how Americans back home are recoiling from the violence and the abuses at Abu Ghraib. Iraqis who support the United States outright could become targets in this nation where the memory of bloody reprisal is recent and real. Tens of thousands of Shiites were killed in 1991, their bodies piled up in mosques, for heeding an American call to rise up against Saddam Hussein after the first war in Iraq. In the end, maybe Americans will say they want their boys back, said Mahmoud Othman, a Kurdish member of the governing council. That is bad. The security situation is not good. We need those troops here. The last empire to tackle the problem of Iraq, or more accurately the empire that created Iraq, from three disparate Ottoman provinces face similar problems. The stronger the hold we are able to keep here, the better the inhabitants will be pleased, Gertrude Bell, the British adventurer, wrote in 1917, after British troops conquered Baghdad from the Ottoman Empire. They can't conceive an independent Arab government. Nor, I confess, can I. But the Shiites rose up in the south in 1920, their rebellion quelled only after hundreds of British and Indian troops died and heavy reinforcements were thrown into the fight. As the debate grows back in Washington about whether Iraq needs a similar infusion of more American troops to quell this insurgency, the lessons of history compete with the reality on the ground here. When American troops tried to crack down on insurgents in Fallujah last month, just the sort of operation that would seem to satisfy Iraqis' cries for security, even those who despise the resistance stood against the American military. It's true that we want the resistance to stop, Ms. Allen said. But innocent people were caught in the middle. By June 30, local leaders, the United Nations envoy Ladur Brahimi, and El Paul Bramer II, the civilian head of the American-led operation, must resolve at least some of the Iraqis' contradictory feelings about the last year, which has both elated and terrified them. The plan has not yet been spelled out, but it will in essence create an interim government leading to full elections, and a constitution next year. Perhaps even more important, it will have to resolve the conflicts in Iraq's psyche, the split among Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. The job might be easier if Iraq could produce a single leader, acceptable to all three groups, who could stand up and say, "We do not trust the Americans. We want them to leave." But to avoid an even worse catastrophe for our nation of Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, we must tolerate them. That catastrophe would be the abandonment of an Iraq that America has only partially built, and that would be likely to fall quickly. Incompletely trained policemen and soldiers might not be able to maintain order, as they could not recently in Fallujah. Violent opportunists could roam the streets, as the militia of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr does now, without the check of American soldiers. Banditry might stop the flow of goods that have raised the standard of living for many after Mr. Hussein's fall. And perhaps, the delicate ethnic and religious lines would crack into a future that few here like to contemplate. The problem is that in the vacuum that Mr. Hussein very deliberately created outside the confines of his own regime, there are no signs of a national leader. Many figures, like Mr. Mehdi or Mr. Othman, who counsel patience with the Americans, are too closely associated with their own groups in their cases, Shiite and Kurd, to play that unifying role. 2 months before the American invasion last year, a Western diplomat holed up in Baghdad waiting for the bombs to drop, summed up the dilemma he saw then with the impending overthrow of Mr. Hussein, and it remains true today. It is important to understand that in Iraqis' minds they have this conflict: I want to change my life, and I want my leader to go, he said. At the same time, I am a nationalist, I am proud of my country, I am humiliated by American policy. It's a mixed feeling. the diplomat added. They are waiting to be liberated, but they are not seeing the Americans as liberators.